History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. In recent history, probably nobody had as broken of an economy as Germany did after World War II. Because of the war and Hitler's scorched earth policy, about 20% of all houses were destroyed. Food production in 1947 was only 51% of its level in 1938. Rationing meant that people were only consuming between 1,000 and 1,500 calories per day, barely above the starvation level. Industrial output in 1947 was only a third of its 1938 level. Most of the working-age men in Germany were dead. There were hundreds of thousands of refugees in Germany who were fleeing the advancement of the Soviet Union. Germany was even more wrecked than Japan. The firebombing of Dresden had completely destroyed that city, and it was more destructive than the atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The city of Cologne had dropped from 750,000 to less than 32,000. Most of the country's historical buildings and churches were destroyed. For all those people who were left homeless, they had to live in shanty towns that would look like a slum in South Africa. Industrial output didn't exist, the money was worthless, and a pack of American-made cigarettes that a GI gave out of charity could be worth more on the black market than hundreds of German marks. William Peterson, a member of the Allied occupation forces, described Germany this way. German men and women, for the most part, ragged, hollow-eyed, thin, forlorn-looking, peddled what wealth had escaped the bombing and burning. Silver, jewelry, Zeiss binoculars, cameras, china, frequently chipped, and bric-a-brac, including ashtrays, lamps, clocks, and cheap paintings, all at fancy prices. I saw a used commonplace alarm clock go for the equivalent of $85 in 1945 dollars. So Germany's economy was completely destroyed. But in the space of less than 20 years, Germany's economy became envied by most in the world. And less than 10 years after the war, people were already referring to a transformation that had happened in the country as the German economic miracle, where production had doubled, tripled, people were living normal lives again, and even though housing, factories, and everything else seemed completely destroyed, they were able to rebuild. These feelings could already be felt by 1948. Shops refilled with goods, the black market closed down, and even absenteeism from work plummeted. In May 1948, workers had stayed away from their jobs for an average of 10 hours a week because the money they worked for wasn't worth much, and they were out foraging or bartering for money. By October, absenteeism was down to 4.2 hours per week. And output grew by leaps and bounds. By 1958, industrial production was more than four times its annual rate for the 6 months in 1948 before the currency reform in the country. Industrial production per capita was three times as high. So what happened here? How did Germany, which was in complete ruins, manage to bounce back? I'm recording this episode in April 2020, when the coronavirus is still what everyone is talking about, and there's a lot of discussion by economists about what's going to happen with the economy. The most optimistic take is called the V-shaped curve, where everything that's happened with layoffs and talk of recession is simply going to bounce right back up to what it was before, because none of our factories have been destroyed in bombs. None of our houses have been destroyed. In a sense, the machine is just going to be started up again. Others say that our global economy is much less resilient than that, and our supply chains have been disrupted. Many other things have been disrupted, so there could be a major recession or even a depression that will happen. Now, I'm not an economist, so I don't know how things are going to shake out, and no one really does at this point. We can only make educated guesses. But what I wanted to do with this episode is look at how societies manage to bounce back and have economic recoveries when their economies have been completely devastated. Something much worse than what we're having in 2020, because again, things haven't been blown up like they have in the case of massive total war. So in this episode, we're going to be looking specifically at the German economic miracle. That's what Germans call the rebound after World War II, the Wirtschaftswunder, economic miracle. And we're going to be looking at how it happened, what were the policies they had in place that allowed this to happen, and also, more specifically, the lessons that were learned from the recent past. Germany also plunged into a terrible depression after World War I, but it didn't rebound from it in the same way as World War II. It had horrible inflation, perhaps the worst in history, and many people think that Germany's rocky economy in the 20s and 30s led directly to the rise of the Nazi Party. Well, nobody wanted that to happen again after World War II, so they saw what went wrong after World War I and made those changes. So that's what we're going to be looking at in this episode. Now, it bears one more look at the challenges that Europe was facing after World War II. First, a brief personal anecdote. A couple of years ago, I met a woman who was in her 70s, and she was from Switzerland, and she mentioned that she was a vegetarian. And I thought that was very interesting because, as far as I understood, the vegetarian movement is something that happened on the latter half of the 20th century, and I didn't know many people of her generation who did that. Was it a dietary reason? Well, the reason is, in Switzerland, in the post-war years, there was no meat available. People couldn't purchase meat, so she grew up not eating meat. By the time most of Europe had rebounded and livestock industries were back and you could purchase meat at a reasonable price, she didn't have the stomach for it. And I wondered how many other stories are like that, where the fallout after World War II is still affecting society 70 years after the fact. Let's take a closer look at what Europe was facing. Now, to say that Germany was devastated is an understatement. Some people refer to the period after 1945 as Year Zero. Most of Europe was in ruins. It was a smoldering crater. There were 60 million dead, 25 million of them Soviet. And many had died by genocide in addition to combatant deaths. There were also millions of displaced persons. Some of them were voluntary refugees that were moving west in the face of the advancing Red Army. Others were deported as undesirable minorities. For example, the newly independent Czech state expelled 3 million ethnic Germans after 1945, and Poland expelled a further 1.3 million. There were orphan children everywhere, 300,000 alone in Yugoslavia. There were also millions of women who had been raped by soldiers, and up to 2 million women had abortions in Germany every year between 1945 and 1948. What made this process so hard is, how do you even begin to rebuild when roads are destroyed, bridges are destroyed, railroad lines are destroyed? You can't buy something because the factory isn't there to produce it, but how do you rebuild the factory when you can't get the necessary equipment there, the construction teams there to rebuild the factory? And what do you pay them with when there's rampant inflation, economies are depleted by nations spending all that they can on their war machine? In Germany, between 20 and up to 70% of housing have been destroyed, and in the Soviet Union, 1,700 towns and 70,000 villages. Vineyards, fields, and forests were ripped to pieces. If we take a look at Asia, millions of acres in North China were flooded after the Japanese destroyed the dikes. Nations where the fighting wasn't as intense, and since Britain and France, also had little to spare. Britain basically went bankrupt fighting the war, and France had been stripped bare by the Germans. And it's because of the aftermath of World War II that colonialism across the globe fell apart. European colonies in Africa and Asia soon disappeared because they couldn't be financed, and this led to independence movements after World War II up through the 60s and 70s. Part of the reason there was so much chaos after World War II is because of the Iron Curtain that went up between mostly the United States and its allies in the Soviet Union. There was no comprehensive peace plan, like a Treaty of Versailles after World War I. There were a number of separate agreements or ad hoc arrangements. The Soviet Union seized back some bits of territory that had lost to Romania in 1919. Poland, as a nation, basically shifted west 200 miles. It called itself a country on wheels. It lost 69,000 square meters to the Soviet Union, and it gained a little bit less than that from Germany in the west. So this is the stage for the chaos in World War II. Now, I mentioned earlier that Germany and other nations managed not to repeat the mistakes of World War I because Germany was able to recover after World War II in a way it wasn't in World War I. So let me turn back the clock even further and take a look at that case. One of the biggest failures of World War I was the peace process. When it ended, the victorious Allied powers put significant reparations payments and treaties on the Central Powers, forcing them to pay for the war, which they thought that they were almost completely responsible. The Central Powers had lost huge chunks of their population due to the war. The Big Four, Great Britain, France, Italy, and the United States, decided that Germany was the chief instigator of the conflict, so they should pay and forfeit the most. According to the terms of the Treaty of Versailles, Germany was forced to give up large portions of its land, about 13%, demilitarize the Rhineland, and significantly lower the number of Germany's military forces. That was one factor, but the other factor too were economic policies coupled with having to pay a huge war indemnity when they couldn't pay for much of anything after the war. One of the problems was that in 1914, at the outbreak of World War I, Germany left the gold standard, which wasn't a problem at the time. There were lots of other nations that did it. But in order to finance the war, instead of taxing its people more, it borrowed huge amounts of money with the help of its national bank in the form of bonds. The Treasury then printed money at a higher rate to pay back these dues, but this was money that wasn't backed by anything. So as a result, a growing percentage of government debt found its way into the vaults of the central bank, and an equivalent amount of money that came right off the printing press came into people's cash holdings. So the central bank was monetizing the growing government debt. Prices and money in circulation rose steadily in Germany from 1914 to 1918 due to wartime expenditures, which wasn't unusual for a country during wartime. But by the time of the armistice in 1918, the amount of money in circulation in Germany had risen by 4% and prices increased by 140%. In order to pay its expenses after the war, the German government didn't stop this policy but continued to print money to pay expenses, workers, and make reparations payments. In order to keep the system afloat, Germany needed gold and a strong foreign currency, but it didn't have this at the time. 5 years after the war ended, in December of 1923, the German bank had issued nearly 500 quintillion marks, making the German mark equal to 1/1,000,000,000,000th of its value in 1914, probably one of the greatest cases of hyperinflation in all of history. In November of 1923, 42 billion marks were worth 1 American cent. But many German government officials didn't recognize the danger of inflation before 1923. After the war, they invested a lot of money for healthcare, education, and other public expenses in order to repair their infrastructure of the country and provide jobs for its returning soldiers. But government expenses skyrocketed, and collecting taxes alone couldn't cover the costs because many of the citizens either couldn't pay any taxes, they were impoverished as a result of World War I, so tax collection plummeted, and the monetization of short-term government by printing out more money resumed, and inflation kept accelerating. So Germany really had no means of being able to break the cycle. It had to make wartime indemnity payments, it had to pay off all the expenses of war, but it couldn't do that because it didn't have the money to do so, so it was printing off more money, which was increasing inflation and driving down the value of their currency, making it harder to pay off their debts, and the cycle continued and continued and continued. From 1914 to 1923, only 15% of the government's expenses were covered by taxes, but due to a drop in their currency and the loss of a tax base, this number fell to 0.8% in 1923. To make a long story short, this chaos in Germany led to the rise of the Nazi Party. One thing that they implemented in order to stop the shock of the system and runaway inflation were price controls. Let me just say a little bit about this, and I'll try to make this as not dry as possible, because price controls are important to understand. They play into this whole story about how Germany suffers after World War I, but how it manages to not make the same mistake after World War II. So what price controls are, it's a restriction set in place and enforced by governments on prices that can be charged for goods and services. Pretty standard dictionary definition. The purpose of this is to maintain the affordability of goods even during shortages and to slow inflation or to ensure a minimum income for providers of certain goods. This is not a new idea. This does not begin in the 20th century. It can go all the way back to the Roman Emperor Diocletian that tried to set a maximum price for all commodities in the 3rd century. But he didn't succeed for reasons I'll get into. This was tried in India in the 14th century as well, and up into the modern era in the United States, price controls were enacted several times. The first came in 1906 as part of the Hepbum Act. In World War I, the War Industries Board was established to fix prices and standardize products in order to boost the war effort. Even in World War II, the National Industrial Recovery Act created the National Recovery Administration to set prices and create a code of what it considered to be fair prices. price controls aren't really supported by modern economists anymore. The reason is that when you install a price ceiling, it keeps prices artificially low. Okay, that's the point. Makes sense so far. But demand is decreased to the point where supply can't keep up. This is where you see empty grocery stores because people are buying things out and they're being sold for far below their value. And producers simply aren't as incentivized to make more of it because they might lose money in the transaction. One Roman writer noted that Diocletian, by various taxes, he had made all things exceedingly expensive, attempted by a law to limit their prices. The much blood of merchants was shed for trifles, men were afraid to offer anything for sale, and the scarcity became more excessive and grievous than ever. Until in the end, the price limit law, after having proved destructive to many people, was from mere necessity abolished. Another factor too, in addition to having empty shelves in grocery stores and other places, goods still appear, but they don't appear in government-backed stores, they appear in black markets, where prices for those reflect what the goods are actually worth instead of those in the controlled market. Black markets flourished in wartime, in World War I and World War II, and practically any war that you can look at. In the United States, when there were restrictions on food, gas, rubber, and metal, these goods were restricted in order to support the war effort and build military equipment, there was a thriving black market also in the United States. One of the main sources of black market goods were farmers. In Britain, farmers declared fewer domestic animal births to the Ministry of Food than actually happened so that they could sell this meat on the black market. Milton Friedman, a Nobel Prize winning economist, said, "We economists don't know much, but we do know how to create a shortage. If you want to create a shortage of tomatoes, for example, just pass a law that retailers can't sell tomatoes for more than 2 cents a pound. Instantly, you'll have a tomato shortage, and it's the same with oil or gas." While Germany enacted price controls in the 1930s and 1940s with one goal in mind, and that was to win World War II. All goods essential to the war were acquired by the government at a reduced cost. And prices were controlled in order to limit inflation, but like any other places, resulted in a black market. Now, it wasn't just an upper limit on prices that was used in price controls. There were also price floors that were introduced for stocks or bonds. This prevented securities from declining in value, so you wouldn't have the same type of death spiral like you saw in the 1920s. What this meant is that stock prices didn't reflect their actual value. So stock markets were frozen and trade dwindled until it was almost non-existent. But if it reflected the actual value, they would have lost heavily as the war effort turned against the Nazis and they wouldn't be able to keep their factories running. Factories may not have liked this, but in the Nazi period, they were run to support the war effort, not to make profits. Many countries had price floors, and they were introduced during World War I in England, in the United States, in Germany, and other countries. Stocks traded at full price, but market makers only had to put up a little bit of the cost of the stocks, waiting until settlement days to balance their accounts. If there were a steep decline in prices, it would have bankrupted many of the stock market's traders. So the price floors prevented panic selling. But trading in many securities stopped because no one was willing to buy shares for less than they were worth. So between January 1943 and June 1948, there was almost no change in the German stock market index, and almost nobody was trading. It was a ghost town. After World War II, the economic situation for Germany got worse. The money supply continued to grow. It expanded fivefold between 1939 and 1945, but the prices of goods were fixed. Ration coupons were given out for some goods, but the amount of rations couldn't meet daily needs for people, and consumers had to turn to the black market. By the time Germany was under military occupation at the end of World War II, they replaced the Reichsmark with a military mark. Western allies tried to limit the issue of military marks to control inflation, but the Soviet sector was willing to print extra marks to pay for the rising cost of occupation. So it was the same process that Germany was facing after World War I of an inflationary death spiral. And the economy was collapsing by the spring of 1948. Food production was only half of what it was in 1938. Industrial production was a third of its pre-war level. Wages were low and many workers failed to show up because salaries were controlled by the government, which led to a decline in production. People devoted their time instead to finding the food they needed to survive. Maybe they would go foraging, maybe they would barter with the goods they did have on the black market. As I said earlier, one of the most reliable units of currency were American cigarettes, kind of like in prison. Cigarettes held their value no matter what. And many soldiers sold their cigarettes on the black market to add to the small salary they were receiving. GIs were issued cigarettes all the time, so this was kind of like a stipend. On the weekends, Germans would leave the cities to go to the countryside to buy food directly from farmers, because there was nothing on the shelves in the city stores. Others grew so-called victory gardens in their backyards to keep themselves from starving. Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. So Germany faced many challenges after World War II, but an advantage that it had that it didn't have in World War I is that the Allies actively looked to help Germany rebuild its economy. And this was decided at the Potsdam Conference. This conference took place from July 17th to August 2nd, 1945, after Germany officially surrendered in World War II. The goal was to achieve sustained peace, but the main focus of the Potsdam Conference was defining and implementing a plan for Germany to promote its economic stability and make it able to repay war reparations without completely bankrupting it like it did in World War I. The four parts of the plan were decentralization, demilitarization, denazification, and democratization of Germany. Another goal was to completely transform the West German economy. The economy of Nazi Germany was based on heavy industry and heavy levels of production. But instead of eliminating industrial and economic capabilities like what happened after World War I and the demilitarization of Germany, the Potsdam Conference wanted to transform Germany and maintain some level of economic strength so it could recover. Germany would become a nation whose economy was based more on efficient agriculture and light domestic industry. Germany was occupied by four zones, and the English, French, and American occupied zones eventually became West Germany, and the Russian occupied zone became Eastern Germany. Originally, Allied powers administered German administrative and economic controls. They were directly involved in running Germany for the first few years, but that was mostly to make sure that Germany wouldn't develop wartime potential right away. But most of the control was later given to the German people so that they would sink or swim after World War II. The most strict restrictions were placed on Germany's wartime industries. The production of arms, ammunition, and implements of war, tanks, and aircraft were prohibited or prevented. And any types of metals or chemicals or machinery that were directly necessary for a war were also rigidly controlled. That was the big build-up to the main point of this episode, which is, how did Germany recover? Let's get to it now that we've set the stage. Like I said at the beginning of this episode, Germany's factories and railroads and cities were completely in ruin after World War II. But the Allied occupational policymakers continued the Nazi government system of price controls that had been imposed before and during the war. Germany's Social Democratic Party wanted to continue controls and rationing, and some American advisors agreed, especially John Kenneth Galbraith. Galbraith was an official of the U.S. State Department. He oversaw economic policy for occupied Germany and Japan, and he'd been the price control czar of the U.S. from 1941 to 1943. In the Soviet zone, factories that weren't destroyed in the war were dismantled and shipped back to the Soviet Union. Sometimes they were used, sometimes they were mothballed and not used at all, but they weren't in Germany. Soviet soldiers, as they had done when they came into Germany in World War II, continued to terrorize the population. And a communist political structure was quickly set up by Stalin. In the Allied zones, American and British troops treated the occupied Germans much better, but the population was still sort of viewed as an enemy, and they weren't shown excessive sympathy or generosity, especially after news of the Holocaust came out. But there were a number of German intellectuals and academics who pushed back against the system of price control. One of the leading figures in this movement was Walter Eucken, who was a professor at the University of Freiburg. He was restricted in what he could say during the Nazi regime, but he and his colleagues had a network amongst themselves that shared ideas of establishing a market-oriented economy. And they had plans for doing this in a post-Hitler period that they all desperately wanted to happen. They followed classical free market economists like Ludwig von Mises and Wilhelm Röpke. And one of Eucken's protégés was an economist named Ludwig Erhard. Erhard was a veteran of World War I, and he earned his PhD in economics in 1925 from the University of Frankfurt. He refused to join the Nazi Party, so this cut short his career. He abandoned academia and joined a business research institute in Nuremberg. He started to work for the American Occupation Forces as an economic advisor in 1945, and he served in several commissions until he was commissioned by Allied authorities to steer the West German economy. Erhard was influenced by a school of economics called ordoliberalism. This has its roots in the University of Freiburg in the 1930s, and it's also closely linked to the classical liberal tradition. For 2 years, Erhard served as the economics minister in the American zone in Bavaria from 1946 to 1948, and he advocated market reforms. In radio broadcasts, he told his German audience that they had essentially brought their current situation on themselves, and they could only get out of it through saving, self-responsibility, hard work, and restore their prosperity. In 1948, the British and American zones were combined into one administrative unit, and Erhard was now the director of economics. In June of 1948, he instituted two pieces of reform that completely transformed the German economy. The first was to restore money stability, and his second policy sought to end inflation after effects from the Nazi period. The first policy was to introduce a new currency, and people could exchange 10 of the old marks for one of the new to reduce the money supply, keep inflation under control, and also give people hard currency. But the second one was much more radical. He wanted to completely abolish price and production controls. Without any approval from the Allied military command, one Sunday, when the authorities were out of their offices, Erhard announced on the radio that the very next morning, all price controls would be abolished. This was a very radical movement. He was undoing decades of established policy in Germany overnight. Allied leaders were shocked by this. They thought this was far too radical. It would lead to complete and total chaos. General Lucius Clay, who was commander of American forces in Germany, he called Erhard into his office and said, "Herr Erhard, my advisors tell me you're making a terrible mistake." And Erhard replied, "Don't listen to them, General. My advisors tell me the same thing." So what he announced is that first, each German would be given 40 Deutschmarks that replaced the old currency of the Reichsmarks. This would be followed by a second installment of 20 Deutschmarks, basically giving people money to buy things when they may have very well had no money or they were relying almost completely on bartering because the Reichsmarks were completely useless. All debts and credits would be converted into this new currency at the rate of 10 to 1, and people would have to prove how they came by sums that exceeded 5,000 Reichsmarks, so that way people weren't just gaming the system and taking too much of this new currency. Erhard knew that his plan wouldn't succeed if the new money were used by people, but then they went into empty stores and empty warehouses like the old currency had faced. That's why he announced the complete abolition of wage and price controls. No use in introducing a new currency if it can't be used on anything. The plan is that first, controls would end on an enormous range of consumer goods. Then, within 6 months, controls on food would be dropped. He promoted these measures by claiming that they were a patriotic move to replace a foreign economic system that had been imposed on Germany, even though that had happened from within and not without. Erhard believed, as do most modern economists, that 2,000 years of data going back to Diocletian showed that wage controls and price controls didn't work. They always ended in a lack of goods, they destroyed incentives, and they transferred wealth from citizens into the hands of bureaucrats and those favored by the government. Well, the effects were dramatic. As I described at the top of this episode, it was as if stores came to life. Black markets disappeared. Buying and selling with Deutschmarks replaced barter. Almost overnight, factories began to belch smoke again, and observers said they could see delivery trucks crowding the streets and the noise of construction crews clattering throughout the cities again. The success of this was unmistakable. A few months later, the French zone followed suit, and industrial production skyrocketed. In the second half of 1948, industrial production increased nearly 50% from its June level. A year later, at the end of 1949, the production was 81% above what it had been when the reforms were first implemented. Prices did spike initially when sellers could sell things for what the market value made them actually worth instead of a price control. But by the end of 1950, there was greater industrial and agricultural output that was offered on a more open market, which reduced the cost of living because they produced the goods that people wanted and at economies of scale, they were cheaper. After the French, British, and American zones merged in 1949, growth continued, and Erhard then became the Minister of Economic Affairs. West Germany grew rapidly and East Germany did not. Between 1950 and 1960, Germany eventually surpassed France and the United Kingdom, despite receiving much less Marshall Plan aid. From 1950 to 1960, the West German economy's real output more than doubled, and it grew for a decade at a compounding annual rate of 8% a year. It wasn't just the lack of price controls, but it was a growing labor force and investment flows that allowed Germany to catch up to a low level of initial output. It's by the end of the 1950s that you hear the term Wirtschaftswunder, or economic miracle, the way that Germany was so quickly able to rebound, and only in a little more than a decade, it went from a pile of rubble to a modern Western European nation. Now, it's worth looking at East Germany a little bit because it provides a very useful case study comparing it to West Germany because they were all one common nation and then split off into two divergent paths. It's a good A-B test, as they say in internet marketing. Because the Reichsmark was now worthless in Western Germany after it was replaced by the Deutschmark, the Soviets introduced a new currency as well into Eastern Germany, called the Ostmark. It continued to circulate in Eastern Germany for the next 40 years. The exchange rate between the Ostmark and the Deutschmark was officially set at 1-to-1, but the Ostmark always traded at a discount. If you went to East Germany in the 80s and exchanged currency on the black market, exchange rate was more like 5 Ostmarks to 1 Deutschmark. After the currency reform in Western Germany, the Soviets blocked all roads into the Soviet zone, which made West Berlin inaccessible. The currency reform of 1948 directly led to the Berlin blockade and also the airlift from allies that saved the people of West Berlin from starvation. They were closed off by the Soviets on all sides, so allies airlifted thousands and millions of tons of crucial supplies so they didn't starve, and I think I've covered the Berlin airlift in another episode. So this separation of Berlin from East and West, which went from 1948 to 1989, was started by this economic plan. Eastern Europe did not develop, and after the fall of communism and the reintegration of Eastern and Western Germany, the eastern part of Germany has always lagged and in many ways continues to lag economically from areas in Western Germany. And not only did factories spring up and industry spring up all over Western Germany, but the stock market recovered. The German stock market recovered its pre-currency reform level by 1952. By 1953, Germany officially defaulted on its foreign debts and replaced old bonds with new ones, which had lower interest rates and extended maturity. Capital controls were lifted, and the Deutschmark was now considered a strong currency that stood by the pound and the lira and other European currencies. Now, one other thing that did aid Germany's economic recovery, it wasn't just a drastic change in its economic plans. The Marshall Plan also did have an effect. The Marshall Plan were funds given by the United States to nations destroyed in World War II to rebuild war-torn regions and remove trade barriers and modernize industry. And also, importantly, to prevent the spread of communism. It wasn't completely altruistic. The Marshall Plan initially offered aid to the Soviet Union, but they refused to accept it because they didn't want the United States to have a degree of control over communist economies. The Soviet Union prevented its satellite states like East Germany and Poland from accepting it. The Marshall Plan resulted in $12 billion in aid distributed to Western Europe, and Germany was one of the largest recipients, taking about 11% of the $12 billion. So this allowed it to stimulate domestic industry, repair their broken highways and hospitals and power lines. And other nations also benefited. From 1948 to 1951, those that did receive aid from the Marshall Plan had a rise in gross national product by at least 15 to 25%. And interestingly, the engineer of the Marshall Plan, George Marshall, who was Secretary of State, later received the Nobel Prize for Peace, and he was the only general in history to do so. Funding ended in 1953, but the economy of every participant state had surpassed pre-war levels. Output was at least 35% higher in 1951 than it was in 1938. However, I think that the effect of the Marshall Plan wasn't as big as other things that led to Germany's economic revival. The Marshall Plan aid to West Germany wasn't that large. Yes, they did take the largest share of it, but cumulative aid from the Marshall Plan and other aid programs only totaled $2 billion through October 1954, through all the years that it was in effect. When aid was at its peak in 1948 and 1949, the Marshall Plan was less than 5% of German national income. And while Western Germany was receiving aid, it was also making reparations and restitution payments over $1 billion. The Allies charged the Germans $2.4 billion for their cost of occupying Germany. Although this is partly offset by the fact that Germany didn't need to pay for its own defense at this period. If you don't have to maintain a standing army, that saves a lot of money. So, in conclusion of this episode, I think the case of Germany after World War I and World War II show good examples of how to rebuild economy and how not to rebuild economy. And this is also affected by what others do to a nation that is economically devastated. Germany after World War I was heavily reliant on foreign loans, their people were starving, they had a worthless currency, and their government was unstable, which set the perfect conditions for the rise of the Nazi Party and Adolf Hitler. Western Germany, in contrast, had an economic policy that opened up free markets, it had the support of its former enemies from the war, it was given foreign loans, the reparation payments were reasonable given its current situation, and by the 1950s and 1960s, West Germany had the strongest economy in Western Europe, perhaps even the world. They had a strong currency, were extremely independent, they had limited reliance on imports, and had a booming industry. Much of the failures after World War I were due to what Germany did. Their economic policy of pumping out money led to hyperinflation. So it's arguably only fair that Germany gets the credit for what happened after World War II. Now, an advantage Germany did have is that its population was well-educated and had a lot of technical skills, so even if factories were destroyed, Germany's productive capacity was never completely eliminated in the war. It was still much higher than before the war started. Germany quickly repaired its infrastructure, especially the bottleneck sectors that the Allies had destroyed. So employment and worker productivity rose, allowing Germany to regain its productive potential and transfer the wartime economic model to a domestic industrial model. And Germany had almost peasant-like agriculture before World War II, as did many nations on Earth, where some farmers mostly used machinery, but there were some who didn't. Germany was forced to provide food for its starving people and the large number of Allied soldiers occupying it, so they quickly mechanized their agricultural sector and became one of the most advanced on Earth. So it became more efficient with its agriculture and moved much of its population to domestic industry. So with these plans in place, without crippling reparations payments on them, they were able to succeed. And almost everything about the post-war plans were a success. The treaties, the plans like the Marshall Plan, the move for economic unification and reducing trade barriers in Western Europe, were all done to unite Western Europe politically and economically in order to promote sustained and lasting peace. And with military alliances like NATO, it meant that there were successfully no major wars in Western Europe from after World War II until now. So this analysis of economic recovery, it doesn't apply to everything. It might not apply directly to things like pandemics, where because we're looking specifically at how a war-torn nation rebuilds, hopefully this at least gives some optimism that a nation that comes from essentially a pile of rubble can rebuild and become one of the most modern nations in the world in a period of only a little over a decade. All right, so that is all for the episode today. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spymasters include Bill Ivey, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael from New York, Carl from Norway, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French Lee, Jay Carrington, McCrays, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes, where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.